and not have enemies. You are going to at least have at least one enemy. And people say, well, is that something you made up? I said, look in the Quran. It says, for every prophet, we have sent an enemy. So if you're a follower of that prophet, you're going to have enemies.
Quite.
This is something, it's not, you know, God is giving us is informing us of a reality when he says that in the Quran. He's informing us of a reality. For every prophet, we sent an enemy. So if you're a follower of the prophet, you're going to have enemies. If you're not,
quite,
you might not have enemies. And this brings us to a very, very important subject, which is something that we need to discuss as believers, as a community, as believing Muslims, which I think has been a major, major problem in the Muslim community. And that is that we have a very distorted and, I believe, wrong understanding of what it means to be a holy person.
Now, that's a point I wanted to raise as well, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, because when you talk about holy people, there's a false image out there that somehow a holy guy is nice to everyone. That's not what being holy is about, is it?
Well, I would say, in principle, what you're saying is right. The point of being a holy person is not that you are somehow, you know, blissfully, you know, riding, you know, a foot above the ground and, you know, everything that around you turns into flowers.
Flowers and all that kind of thing, yeah.
That's not what it is.
Yeah.
Okay?
And somehow Satan can sing from the same hymn sheet as yourself.
Right. The whole point of religion, and I mean religion in the larger sense of religion, those religions that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed, you know, time of existence of humanity.
True.
They are there as a source of distinguishing humans, not as necessarily getting everyone together.
That's right. It's distinguishing them, isn't it?
It's about distinguishing.
It's differentiation.
Distinguishing,
talking about.
Not in a racist way, not in a
based on merit,
chauvinistic
isn't it?
Way, in the sense of. And this is one of the main arguments that the people who are against religion will say about religion. Religion divides people.
Yes.
Religion causes wars. Religion causes evil. Religion encourages, you know, the base instincts of people.
Mm.
And I'm sure that religions have done this in history.
Of course they have.
Because people are involved with religions.
Of course they
So
have.
The people that are involved in religions do this.
Yes.
It could even be me. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
You know, this is distinguished from the issue of what the job of religion is.
Mm.
The job of religion is to distinguish people. Based on one basis, those who accept the truth and try to act on it in their life,
yes,
and those who reject it and fight it. Okay, I said it in a very general way because I don't want it to, you know, this is a universal matter, whether it was, you know, the revelations that were given to the older prophets and the prophets before Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, or whether it's the revelation that was given to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which is the first universal and the final revelation.
Sure.
It's there to distinguish people. It's not about everybody getting together and, you know,
singing kumbaya.
Exactly. It's not about that.
No.
For God's sakes.
I mean, this is the thing.
It doesn't mean you treat other people badly. It doesn't mean
you don't respect them. No, no, no.
It doesn't mean that you don't live with them. It doesn't mean that you don't cooperate in certain matters.
No.
Okay, but it's not about everybody. Oh, everybody's the same. Everybody's just as good. Oh, you know, go kiss the hand of the person who just stole from you. Oh, go. You know.
And, you know, slap me on the other cheek, you know, that kind of thing. No, that's not what it's about. No.
So, when somebody understands this reality of religion
because
and starts acting on that, obviously they're going to polarize.
Well, the thing is that what's more polarizing, I would say, is, you know, one of the principles that we have in Islam, which, you know, is even difficult for even Muslims to act upon with other fellow believers, and that is to enjoin the good and forbid the evil.
Which is an example of that.
This is really the heart and crux of what we're seeing here, because this polarization, there's a legislative, a ruling bylaw, divine law, that says, well, you know, okay, you can be a good person, you believe in the truth, that's great. God says that's wonderful. But when you see your neighbor doing something, or your friend, or your brother doing something I forbade, well, it's your job to go and tell him not to do that. That's hard.
Yeah, because
your brother's not going to like you for that.
Well, it could be that when you say to somebody, you know, please don't do that.
No. Or your father, for example.
Or whoever.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Obviously, they're not going to like it.
They're not going to like it.
If they're into doing that.
Yeah.
or if they feel like, who are you to tell me?
Yeah, exactly.
They might and even know that it's not good.
Yeah, I mean, especially in societies where, you know, you and I have lived, you know, in Scotland, for example, I know that if you say, you know, Jim, don't have a drink, you get punched in
don't,
the face.
Don't say it.
You don't say it.
Right, you don't say that to Jim, right?
But don't say it to Jim. But, you know, if you say it to Abdul,
yeah,
you've got a point, you know. Exactly. So this is the whole point, isn't it? That when we get down to the crux of the matter, this Amr bin Maruf is a very important beauty. And this is one of the things that, you know, that even when we discuss Ashura, when we discuss Muharram, when we discuss, you know, these great changes, these great events that change the course of history, this is the hardest principle on which to act upon as a believer. And this is the test. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, because this is the real
test. So this is the deal. Actually, if you read the Islamic government, Hukumat Islami Balad Faqih,
that's
the
right,
book by Imam.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good book to read. It's not simply a legal treatise.
No, it's not.
It's
no.
more than that.
Oh.
He talks about the fact that we were beset mm. in the Muslim world by what he called, or the way it's translated, is pseudo-saints.
Pseudo-saints,
yes. In Farsi, it's khushk muqaddas.
Right.
Which, if you want to translate it, you know, very literally, is dried up holy person.
A dried up holy person.
Right. A dry holy person.
I've heard of dry apricot, but,
right.
you know.
Basically, what he's trying to say is that it's a fake, it's this fake holiness.
Sure.
You know, don't get involved with politics.
That's right. It's trying to
don't get involved with politics.
Exactly.
You know, be nice to everybody. You know, if mm-hmm. the Shah is coming, you know, go kiss his hand.
Yeah.
Because, hey, he is the Shah and you're part of, you know.
Sure.
And there's that famous story. Mm. Again, we're talking about Imam Khomeini and his personality.
This is the late 50s. And
the Shah announces, I'm coming to Qom to have a meeting with the ulama.
Right.
Because I'm the Shah, I can do this.
I see.
And they all have to attend.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So this is the picture. Imagine this.
Sure.
So the Shah rides into, well, figuratively speaking, you know, with the car. He was a car. He drives into Qom.
He drives into Qom.
Which is, you know, at that time, maybe 2-3 hours from Tehran with the roads and the cars of that time. Right. And he enters the room where all the main ulama are seated.
Yes.
And as Iranian custom, as Eastern custom, they all get up.
Mm.
Except who?
Imam Khomeini.
Exactly.
God bless his grace.
Exactly.
What a man.
And I just something popped in my mind right now. It's the reverse thing what Shaitan did.
Mm.
Who, when God said, bow to the Imam of the
Very
age.
Very good point. Excellent.
He didn't bow.
Mm.
This is Imam doing the reverse.
Verse.
Which is the guy who comes in and he says, you know, King of Kings and, you know,
the axis
of time, you know, Qutb-e Zaman and whatever, all
sure.
the things that the Iranians used to call their kings.
Yes.
He doesn't stand up for it.
He doesn't stand.
And, you know, it was a scandal.
Ooh.
It was
I'm
a
sure
scandal.
He didn't.
Everybody's like, oh my God,
mm.
you know,
mm.
Ayatollah Khomeini didn't stand up for, you know, the
yes.
king.
Yes.
You gotta love him.
He was doing the right thing.
He's like, you know what? I'm not gonna stand up for the king.
Yes, and what are the other ulama doing? You know, I mean, did he pass something in Qom for which they should be standing up for?
Right.
You know?
So
this guy was, you know.
So,
yeah.
The point is that obviously doing things like this is gonna upset some people.
Of course.
Even people who are quote unquote religious.
Ah.
Even people who are quote unquote, you know, whatever. We live according to Islam. Well. Part of Islam is that you don't show respect to somebody who is a zalim and who kills people and who tortures people and imprisons
sure.
people without
and doesn't deserve that kind of respect.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Right. And they say, well, what about? Isn't he also just a human, the king? You know, isn't he just deserve that normal, basic, you know, thing that a human does? Well, we're like, well, no. Once you do certain things, you
yeah. I mean, once
you're disqualified from
you're
that
disqualified
from that list
from God's.
You're
you
not.
Know.
It's not that he's not human. It's just, you know, you have to act human.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's not like you're physically a human being. Therefore, you know,
yeah.
you have to act like you.
And if you're a fasik, then you know,
fasik is fasik.
Yeah, you're out.
Okay. Mate. There are certain things that are no longer. And we're not talking dry, you know, legal aspects of
no.
things.
No.
Okay.
No.
So. We have this person, Imam Khomeini. He does these things from way back.
Mm.
We're not even talking.
No, it's not even. Yeah.
I'll give you another example,
please.
This is during his, I think this was in the 30s or 20s. I'm sorry, 30s or 40s.
Sure.
They're in Fezziyeh, and some mentally deranged person comes in
mm-hmm.
with a knife.
Yes, he was going to stab the imam.
And they were going to stab different, he was going around threatening people.
People.
So most of the Most of the ulama, they fled.
Mm-hmm.
What did Imam do?
He slapped him.
He gave him a big slap.
Slap right in his hand. The knife fell from the hand, and the man was shaking.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, oh, this is not appropriate. You know, if somebody is threatening a Rouhani and... You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What should... You're a Rouhani, you're a cleric, and then somebody is threatening you with a knife. What's the, you know, the pseudo-saint way of reacting? Is to just, you know, fold up and be like, oh, please don't kill me, or my son, you know, go ahead and take my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right? Mm. So, but what's the real way, what's the real answer?
The real answer is to give him a good bloody hiding, as we... would see in Scotland.
Right?
Yes.
The whole story with Jim and Abdullah, right?
Yeah,
Abdul,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
Right?
Because the thing, you know, quite rightly so, because, I mean, here's a...
That's what a holy person, a real holy person,
does.
Okay? Because the guy is going to damage himself as well.
Exactly.
If he stabs somebody, he's going to have to be punished. He's going to go... So, Imam, I'm saying this as an example. People are like, oh, you're mythologizing him and turning...
No,
it's about what is your reaction when a real thing happens in your life.
Sure.
Okay?
And this required decisive action. I mean, the thing is that let's not even... I mean, you mentioned that example, and I thank you for that. And, of course, you know, this is all to the credit and greatness of Imam Khomeini, because now we realize what kind of personality he's going to become later on. But, of course, you know, we see this with the prophets as well. I mean, Prophet Moses punches a guy and knocks his lights out,
right?
Well, I put that in, you know, in the nicest possible way I can.
Right.
But he killed him. Right? And this was one of Pharaoh's soldiers, one of his guards, right? And that was a serious offense. I mean, that was the death penalty, you know? And that's what I'm saying. I mean, there's a precedent for this.
Exactly.
This is what real men do.
Well, the point is that when you stand up for truth, this polarizes people.
Sure.
This repulses some people.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that's what a really saintly person does. Okay, especially in, you see, this is the beautiful thing about Islam, which is different than the other things that the other religions have become.
Exactly, these sort of pseudo.
Okay, right. The ideal, for example, in some of the Christian churches has become to, you know, be a monk.
Yeah.
Or be some sort of a recluse, or be a celibate.
Exactly.
Which
exactly.
is, they say, you know, you,
yeah,
you like in the Catholic Church,
yeah,
like in the Catholic Church, you can't be priest unless you're celibate.
Yeah.
Which, you know. You know, there is a history of fighting and soldier and priests going to war, but it's not the dominant vision of what a thing is. Okay?
Yes, exactly.
Or, you know, in certain Eastern traditions where it's like, you know, you got to renounce the world and whatever and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not the truth.
No, it's not.
That's not the truth.
Yeah.
Okay? So we have a person like Imam Khomeini who is the embodiment and manifestation of his teachers, which are the Ahlul Bayt, which is the Prophet, peace be upon him, which is Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Sure.
And I would say that even among the imams, you have a very special... Obviously, we always say that Imam Ali has the top position among the imams.
Of course.
And he's also the one that is the most... And we're not talking about what's going to happen with the zuhur of Imam Zaman. We're talking about those that we've experienced. He's the one that is the most, you know, attracting and repulsing of all of them.
Sure.
And there are many, many stories of him, you know, in the early history of Islam. And so I'm not going to go through all of them.
No.
But I'll give you another example of Imam Khomeini. So
please.
We were talking about this previously, where, you know, he flies into Tehran after years and years of exile.
Yeah.
You know, in order to lead the revolution. And he's at the at the airport, I'm sure you remember.
Yes.
And, you know, they bring the children's choir, and they're singing that beautiful, you know, choral.
Surud. Yes.
Surud that about Imam.
Yeah.
And, you know, very emotional.
Yes, it
scene.
Was. It was a
you
very
know,
emotional.
People
scene.
Were losing it.
Yeah, losing
people were
it.
Crying
yeah.
and
yeah, absolutely.
Imam, not a flicker of a muscle on his face.
Face, exactly, exactly.
Totally. Okay. Then the reporter says to him, "Oh, you know the
yeah.
Eastern kind
yeah.
of
yeah.
style of like, you know, so after all these years
yes,
of
yeah.
you know,
hmm.
What's your feeling about you know coming back to your homeland?" And he just looks at him and says.
Heech.
That famous Heech.
That
right?
famous Heech.
Right. So
that caught the BBC by the pants, as they say.
Right.
You know, it really.
So
you know,
obviously, people are like,
what
does
that
mean? He's a holy person. Shouldn't she? You know, people are expecting him to give like some long, Hafez's poem about, you know.
Yeah, Hafez's poem or something, you know, something right. mystical right. about it's his
like
return.
Some, you know.
You know, the rise of a phoenix or something like that, you know.
You know, phoenix rising out of the ashes.
Yeah, exactly, out of the ashes,
you know,
or something,
like,
you know.
That's what they expect.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
this is the cultural thing that they think
absolutely,
is going to. And his whole thing is, it's not about this.
It's not about,
you know, this kind of rituals. It's not about the, it's about the reality of things.
Exactly.
Okay? What's your feeling about him?
Nothing.
Whether I'm there or here.
Live with it.
Well, what is he saying? Let's think about this for a second.
Yeah, exactly.
He's saying that it doesn't matter where I am in the world.
Exactly.
The world is not that important, actually.
No.
Okay?
Yeah.
Whether I am, you know, in exile, you know, in difficulty, or whether I'm the leader of a nation.
That's not important.
What's your feeling? Nothing.
Nothing.
That's the goal. Is that it should make it shouldn't make a difference.
And it make a difference.
Whether you're the leader or not the leader. Okay?
Fantastic.
If you're the leader, you have the same feeling as though you were, you know, some respectable old cleric, you know, sitting in his home giving lessons to his
students.
Yeah. Okay?
Sure.
Fantastic. And this is the test that Allah wants from us. The things I'm saying, obviously I'm not applying to myself because I fail in all those. I'm trying to simply understand what a person like Imam Khomeini, who in our time was really the closest we had to, you know, that masum guidance that you could see, you know, with your own eyes. At least in my experience,
absolutely.
You know, whatever. I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah,
I feel that way. This is his deal. He's like, it doesn't matter. I've, you know, there's millions of people waiting in the streets to greet me, and you know, I'm not impressed by this. Which is great. You know, it's fantastic.
Yeah, right? It really is. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it was a big eye opener. I mean, as
it's fantastic,
saying,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he goes to Beit Zahra.
Zahra, yeah.
And, you know, it's, again, very emotional, even more so emotional than you know, at the airport, because we're going to the graves of the martyrs. The
martyrs'
families are there.
Yeah.
And then they sing that song, that poem, which is, you know, just thinking about it, you know, sends shivers down my spine, you know?
Sure.
It's the surud about the shuhada.
Yes.
And everybody knows it in Iran, and it's an amazing poem.
Yes.
And if you look at the film, everybody is crying.
Yes.
You know, his son, Haj Ahmad, is crying. Aina Ternuri is sitting
yeah.
there. He lost his turban.
I remember the film.
Yeah?
Yes, I remember.
Everybody's crying.
Crying, yes.
Everybody's crying.
Except
Imam. So, you know, in an Eastern emotional society, like,
yes.
like...
And where the Imam does get emotional is the point where he says, I'm going to smash this government in the teeth.
Exactly.
And that's what it's about, mate.
Listen,
yeah.
And this is the thing for them. They are shocked. They're like, oh my God, a cleric.
Yeah.
An old 80-year-old cleric.
Mm.
Isn't he supposed to be the one that, you know, oh, let's invite Aghay Bakhtiari and let's invite so-and-so and let's get it together and let's come to some, you know. And he's like, no. This person who is the prime minister is not legitimate.
No.
Because the person who appointed him wasn't legitimate.
No. Absolutely.
Right? Because they said to him, they said, again, we're repeating some of the history, but I think this is very good
very important to
see what a personality of a real holy person
is like.
Because they said to him when he came to Iran, I mentioned this in previous programs, I want to repeat it because I think it's a very interesting story.
Sure.
They said to him, you know what, fine, the Shah has left, Bakhtiar has taken over the government, why don't you just go back to Iran, go to Qom and, you know, be the Ayatollah Uzma.
Yeah.
Do your Ayatollah Uzma thing.
And leave,
and let
Bakhtiar
do the government.
The
every now and then, if you really think a red line is being crossed, issue a fatwa. Well, we'll live with that.
We'll live with that.
What did he say? Oh, and then they threatened him. It was a thruffer, right?
Yeah, it was a thruffer. Yes.
They said, and if you don't do that, we will tell the military to conduct a coup d'état, and they will arrest all of you and execute all of you.
Yes, and he said, I will declare.
He said, and this is the Americans sending him this message through Ibrahim Yazdi, who was leader of the Freedom Movement. Who.
Yeah.
You know, had good connections with the Americans.
Sure.
Because of his time living in America and being a U.S. citizen.
Sure.
Okay? So, at that time, through Ibrahim Yazdi, they sent him a message saying this. What is his response? I will declare jihad.
Yes.
What did Kissinger say?
He said something we don't understand.
He said, we don't understand what he's... from where he's coming from.
Coming from,
right.
Exactly.
He's
using religious terminology and religious...
Yeah, it's not something we learned in Harvard.
Right,
it's not something I can teach at Harvard
no.
to the kids, you know, about, you know... It doesn't fit to the 19th century, you know, European balance of power state model. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
He's from another time and place. We don't know what to do with him.
No.
So, here's a man. He says to the Americans, "Hey, you do this, it's jihad."
Mm-hmm.
He comes to Iran. How do you feel? What's your feeling? Peach.
Peach.
He comes to Bezara.
Yes.
Doesn't cry when everybody, the whole nation's crying.
He doesn't cry.
And then he says, "You know what? I'm going to suck this. I'm going to punch this government to the mouth."
Mouth. Because it's not legitimate.
It's not legitimate. And with the help of the people, I am going to establish a government.
That's where he was very passionate.
I as a religious leader, not I as a man personal, whatever.
One. Yes.
Me as the head and, you know, top legal scholar, I'm going to establish a government. And we're going to have an Islamic Republic.
Probably.
Although he didn't mention Islamic Republic in that.
At that time, but of course later on that was the case.
So, all this stuff, completely against the grain of, you know, Eastern culture, Iranian culture, whatever, even certain other things.
Yes.
You see this with Imam Ali, alayhi salam, going completely against some of those Arab, customs.
Yes, in a very...
That tribal favoritism with your tribe, with your family, you know, all those things that, you know, you would... That really are a way of preventing haq, of preventing the truth happening.
Yeah.
This famous example of when his cousin wants money from Baitul Mal, which we mentioned before, program.
He put a hot pebble in his.
Yeah, he had, you know, he couldn't see very well, Imam Ali alayhi salam put a hot coal in his hand and said, this is, feel this, this is hell when you take money from
Baitul Mal.
Right?
Yes.
So people think, oh, that's very harsh, that's very, you know.
No, that's not harsh.
He's just telling him. He's getting to the point.
He's getting to the facts. That's going to happen anyway.
Right.
You know,
so he's getting it.
Put this coal in your hand.
He's getting
or not.
There quicker than maybe somebody else.
Somebody else, yes.
And this is the same with Imam Khomeini.
Sure.
He came. He did the things that he had to do. He was successful, and that's why, you know, tens of millions of people loved him, and tens of millions of people hated him. And Allah likes that.
Allah likes that. Thank you very much. On that note, sir, thank you very much indeed for the contribution for the man who changed the world. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners and to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Meet Clarion, a homemade polar bear whose mission is to raise awareness of climate change in a 500-kilometer pilgrimage to Glasgow. The 3-meter polar bear is work of British furniture maker Bamber Hoss. The bear weighs 17 kilograms and is made of bamboo, willow, and tissue paper. Hoss started his journey with Clarion from his hometown of Bishop's Castle in England to Glasgow. They accomplished their spectacular journey ahead of the United Nations COP26 climate conference in the Scottish city. Hoss says Clarion is a symbol of melting Arctic ice caps due to global warming.
He's called Clarion. Clarion the bear is not a bear. He is a metaphor. He's a symbol. It is a very obvious symbol that a polar bear represents the Arctic, not the Antarctic, and that is where, you know, some of the problems are with melting ice caps. Not all the problems, because they're elsewhere as well.
Hoss says his aim is to encourage people to pay attention to climate change. Environmental activists from across the UK and elsewhere on the continent have also embarked on a long journey on food to reach the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow. Did you know that animals might have the potential to help tackle climate change? Strange indeed. But that seems to be the case according to scientists. The sheep on a remote Scottish island have a special diet that consists mainly of seaweed. This feature is what scientists are hoping can help reduce global warming. Sheep usually feed on grass, and the process contributes to methane emissions. But scientists say the sheep in Orkneys are unique because of spending the winter eating only the marine plants. Listen to one researcher explaining whether fitting seaweed into the sheep diet can actually help reduce gas emissions.
The main thing at the moment is we need to absolutely prove, one, which seaweed is going to be the best for this, what amount of seaweed into the feed gives the best effect, and then can you scale that up to a level where you would actually have an effect on the overall UK farming?
If proven, the Scottish sheep and their unique diet could lead to a breakthrough in methods for livestock breeding, which is a major source of greenhouse gases. Methane is about 30 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the atmosphere.
Flocks of sheep are on the streets of Madrid. The animals have made their way through the center of the Spanish capital to follow ancient migration routes. Shepherds accompanied their sheep and goats moving through the streets of the Spanish capital. They actually marked a centuries-old annual tradition that began in 1994. The event allows shepherds to migrate their cattle from summer to winter pastures. They do so based on a deal struck in 1418 that allows the animals to walk through the city freely. The event attracts hundreds of people. It was canceled last year due to the pandemic, but this year, many locals came out to watch.
The Philippines is among the countries facing a soaring plastic waste crisis. However, a group of recyclers are working hard to tackle the problem, turning the waste into building materials. The group is called the Plastic Flamingo, or simply the PLUF. They gather bottles, single-use sachets, and snack food wrappers. The waste is then shredded and molded into post-add planks that can be used for decking and fencing. Their products are also durable enough to make disaster relief shelters and urban furniture. The group says the coronavirus pandemic has worsened the plastic waste problem, sparking a rush for protection equipment. Their disposal is a matter of concern now.
Because of the plastic problem we're currently facing, the pandemic, the huge accumulation of plastic use, there's also improper disposal. People are unaware on, you know, how do I dispose these plastics? Where do I dispose of them? So at the same time, we give that avenue also that instead of putting it in landfills or oceans in general, you know, you give it to the PLUF, you give it to recycling centers like us, and we would recycle these, upcycle them into better products.
The PLUF says surging online shopping is also another problem that they try to address. The group has collected over 100 tons of plastic waste since it started the business in 2019. However, they still have a lot to do. A UN report says some 300 million tons of plastic waste are produced annually, with South Asian countries accounting for 60% of it. A North Macedonian zoo has a new inhabitant. It may be small, but it has certainly sparked a big amount of joy. The baby marmoset was born 3 weeks ago. Its parents are super protective of their precious offspring. That's why zoo staff have not been able to get close to the baby and determine if it's a male or a female. The tiny primate will be given a name after its sex is known. Marmosets are the world's smallest monkeys. On average, they are about 13 centimeters long and weigh up to 100 grams. The adorable animals can be found in a number of countries in the Americas.
The hustle and bustle of modern life has made it difficult to communicate with nature the way humans used to do a few decades ago. Now, a giant statue in the state of New York reminds us of the importance of lending an attentive ear to our surroundings. The massive statue, named Water's Soul, is located along the Hudson River. Her woman's head, with her index finger pressing on her lips, seems she's asking bystanders to maintain silence. It's a work of 66-year-old Spanish artist Juanme Palenza. He says the message of his work is, quote, to call on people to listen to the profound noise of the water talking to us. Water's Soul was made of polyester resin, fiberglass, and marble dust at a Barcelona studio. It was later shipped to its Jersey City site for assembly. The sculpture is 24 meters tall.
You might have heard of Iran's stellar wrestling achievements or about its soccer team, but that's not all. Another sport has grabbed attention too. Golfers now competing during Iran's national golf tournament in Tehran. This year, 90 participants from around the country played on a very unique golf course. It has only 13 holes instead of the standard 18, but that hasn't stopped golf enthusiasts playing the 13 holes and then repeating the last five to complete the tournament. The good news is that the golf course might not stay so small for long. Iran's Golf Federation hopes to bring in more people interested in golf. But for this to happen, the infrastructure must be provided first.
We don't have the space to use the 350 instructors to train the 3,000 registered men and women across the country, so we decided to build a national academy off the golf course. Course number 18 will be used in a competition venue during tournaments and as a training and education venue during non-competition times.
When the course was built decades ago in northern Tehran, it had five more holes. But over the years, fairways were laid across parts of the field, reducing playable footprint. Tehran's golf club has about 300 members, half are women. Golf has been around in Iran for over a century, and most of the courses are in southern provinces.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Concerned about endangered animals? If yes, then it will be good news that a Mexican zoo has welcomed a newborn zebra. It belongs to the most threatened of the three species of zebra in the world. The foal made a public appearance Thursday, 10 days after it was born at a zoo in northern Mexico. It's about 50 centimeters tall. Its weight, between 10 to 15 kilograms. The newborn equine raises hopes for the conservation of the imperial zebra species.
Somos el único parque en México.
We are the only zoo in Mexico that has this species of zebra. Unfortunately, it is an endangered species. Here at the zoo, we are doing everything possible to preserve and produce them so that in the future, we can repopulate some other parks.
The imperial zebra is native to Africa. It is the largest of the wild equids, the family of horses, donkeys, and other animals. Currently, there are less than 2,500 of imperial zebras in the wild. That's blamed on the destruction of their habitat, illegal hunting, and lack of food.
The world's largest Ferris wheel has opened to public in the United Arab Emirates. Dubbed the Dubai Eye, the wheel takes the visitors to a height of 250 meters. Feast their eyes on the city skyline. That is almost double the height of the iconic London Eye and over 80 meters taller than the high roller in the U.S. city of Las Vegas. Each full rotation of the giant structure takes 38 minutes. The city put on a spectacular firework and light display to celebrate the opening. The 38th edition of the International Short Film Festival has kicked off in the Iranian capital, with some 63 films from 32 countries competing in the event. The festival has for the first time turned into an Oscar qualifying event, giving winning entries a shot at the Academy Awards. This is being held at Tehran's famous Iran Mall cinema complex, and it will showcase short feature, documentary, and experimental works. 5 Iranian films and 58 from abroad are selected for the grand prize, and the winner will be presented to the Academy for possible Oscar nomination. The jury has members from Iran as well as Italy, Japan, and France. The festival will be running until October 23rd.
Natural disasters often disrupt normal life, but that's not the case with an Indian couple who got married despite their town being submerged by floodwaters. The couple, identified by local media as health workers in Kerala State, managed to reach a temple for the wedding in a giant cooking pot. They could be seen smiling and waving in their ceremonial clothes while two of their relatives were steering the pot. The couple reportedly borrowed the pot from the temple, saying that was the only option available. The pair was unwilling to postpone their big day, adding an unforgettable story to a country that is famous for many incredible things. Feeling down, it's all right to cry and get help. That's all what a place called the Crying Room tries to tell its visitors in Spain. The Crying Room is part of a building located in central Madrid. It's free and open to the public. The Crying Room aims to remove the stigma attached to mental health, crying, and seeking help. It offers a wide range of services, from a corner to crying, to a phone with a list of psychologists people can call. Motivating messages are also visible on the walls. People have hailed the initiative, saying it helps them speak out about their negative emotions.
I think it's an excellent idea to visualize the widespread of the mental health issue. And I think it's a really fun take on it, to call it the crying room, because of the Spanish expression, if you want to cry, go to the crying room. So it's kind of stigmatized to cry in Spain, as in many other countries. So I wanted to take part in this this visualization of the problem.
The Crying Room was opened in an effort to raise awareness about mental health and well-being. Official data in Spain showed that around 40% of people had symptoms of depression last year. Another 30% experienced anxiety.
The first movie in orbit in the making. Two Russian nationals who traveled to the International Space Station to shoot scenes of that movie are now back on Earth. The Soyuz MS-18 spacecraft carrying an actress and a film director undocked from the ISS early Sunday and successfully touched down in Kazakhstan about 3 hours later. The film crew, along with a veteran astronaut, blasted off from the Russian leased Baikonur Cosmodrome earlier this month. They spent 12 days in the ISS to shoot the scenes. The mission beats a Hollywood movie project starring Tom Cruise. The mission adds to a long list of firsts for Russia's space industry.
materials and methods are vital for an artist who combines them to create a masterpiece. Well, a Brazilian artist has used an unusual material to create a huge, dazzling artwork. Mandano has drawn a mural measuring 1,000 square meters using ashes from the burned Amazon rainforest. The artwork on the side of a building in the city of Sao Paulo depicts a firefighter standing near the scenes of deforestation, blazes, and dead animals. Mandano says he traveled extensively to feel that sadness and, more importantly, to collect ashes for his paintings. He says his aim is to call attention to the environment in his home country, where thousands of wildfires break out each year.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. I am Musa al-Bahadali, and joining me in the studio today is our dear friend Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid.
Thank you for inviting.
Our question today is as follows. It is actually quite relevant, especially today with all these feminist movements and equal rights and so on and so forth. So the question is as follows. Is it not wrong to use women as tools? Why then does Allah in heaven make use of women using the term huris in such a manner?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the first part is right, that it is not right and good to use women as tools. When we talk about the using women as a tool, we generally refer to what's happening in today's world.
Right.
You know, the women are the main part of advertisement. If you want to advertise even a pamper, a t-shirt of a male, you need a woman next to a male, half naked or something like that.
You need to appeal to the men.
Yes. So even when you go to an office, the secretary should be a woman. I don't know, there are the air hostesses.
Right.
Anywhere where you go, you see a woman being used as a tool, which is not right. Islam has given respect to the woman, an equal respect as there is a man. And the respect of a woman is even more important than a man in some verses and the narrations that we have from the Prophet.
The dignity, especially.
The dignity, the status of a woman,
right,
being a mother, a nurturer, a trainer, the one to whom you can, on whom you can trust and leave your kids. And these are the things that are mentioned in the Quran and in the narrations.
Right, it's not just a purely physical and pleasing figure then.
No, it's not just that. On the other hand, there is a, Islam talks about the equality. For example, if I talk about the man and woman, for the husband and wife, we have a verse, libasun lahun wa libasun lakum. That they are your clothes and you are their clothes,
right,
for husband and wife. That, you know, when I wear a cloth, I'm very much careful about it. It does not become dirty. When
right.
I eat something,
you
I do
take
not
care of it.
Yes, I do not put anything. I try to keep it safe from being dirty, being from being
right.
Misused.
Right.
Even the clothes that I like, I never share it, even with my brother or father.
You take That's extra special care.
Yes. If I have a suit or, a special cloth which I love. So similarly, it's on the other hand as well. Like if a woman has a dress, she takes care of it and
right.
all those things. On the other hand, this cloth, it hides the faults or, it hides my, basically, errors and faults, we can say.
Right.
If I have anything which is needed to be hidden, I use my clothes to hide it.
Right.
Even if a person is you know, having a good gesture, even the cloth helps it to hide it so that everyone cannot approach it. It protects from different types of weathers. You know, we have right. cold and we have hot weather.
Naturally, yeah.
Clothes saves us. So when it talks about the equality, it talks about both parts, that they are your clothes, you're their clothes. So Allah gives this example.
Right.
There are many places in the Quran where it is said mu'minin and mu'min and mu'minat, mu'minin wal mu'minat. They both will go to the paradise. Right. The believing men and believing women. Now what happens is basically there's a general mistake which is done in the translations is that because we do not understand the Arabic language, the adabiyat al-arab, we say Arabic grammar or literature,
right,
we are not familiar with the tone, with the, you know, idioms that are used in that language. Therefore we make mistakes while translating Quran. In the Arabic language or literature, we see when there is a mixed gathering, a masculine verb is used, or a masculine noun. For example, if there are believing men and believing women, the word mu'minin is used. For example, ya ayyuhan nas, o mankind.
And it is inclusive of both genders.
It includes both genders, right. All of them. For example, let me give you a simple example. The simplest example is when we meet someone, what do we say? Assalamu alaykum.
Kum. All right.
Okay. Kum means you all. It's all right. Masculine pronoun. Whereas for the feminine pronoun, we use ki. All
right.
We do not say assalamu alayki. Okay. Or assalamu alaykum kunna. All
right. Right.
Yeah. So.
That would be weird.
Yeah, that would be weird. So we use assalamu alaykum. Peace be upon you all. And we do not say men, because if literally we translate this, the literal right. translation of assalamu alaikum is peace be upon you all men.
And that would be the translation of somebody who does not know the etiquette of the Arabic language.
The one who does not know the etiquettes or the idioms or the way this language has been used, they will literally translate it as peace be upon you all men.
And then we have a new problem, like Islam only says hello to men.
Yes. Islam always says hello to men, and not the women. So therefore, right. even when we see a woman, or, you know, you see a female, you say assalamu alaikum. Right. And they even, like the women to each other, even if they're Arab, they don't say assalamu alayki.
No.
Even in Saudi Arabia, in Iraq, I don't know, Syria, you just count the names of the countries, go and see how ladies meet each other. They say right. assalamu alaikum. So the woman is, a lady is saying to another lady, peace be upon you all men. Right. This is a literal translation, I'm
it's
saying.
It's actually also a sign of respect to say alaykum in plural
that's
form.
That's another point. That's another point. Why it is used as kum for a singular person,
right.
a plural pronoun, it's because to show the respect
right.
to the next person. Because if we say assalamu alayka or ki, it shows disrespect or
right.
equal, like he's equal in rank, not prior. So that shows also the respect. So there are many facts that in the Quran we have many verses where a masculine verb or masculine noun has come in order to talk about the paradise, the blessings or the
right.
things that we will get. But there Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is talking to man and woman all together, not
right.
just the men.
Both of them.
Both of them. Even if the masculine word has been used, it means that the man and woman.
All right.
If Allah wanted to use the two different genders, like it is specific for women and women, we do see in the Quran that Allah mentions Muslimun wal Muslimati.
Right.
The Muslim man and Muslim women. Or Mu'mineen wal Mu'minat. The believing men and believing women. So he brings both of them then.
Right.
He mentions both names.
And there's a point behind that, of course.
There's a point behind that. But generally, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is talking about the paradise, it is in this way. That's the first thing.
Right.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Second, is there a gender in the paradise or not? Does soul has a gender or not? That's another question.
Right.
When we refer to the Muslim philosophers and in some of the narrations, we see that the soul does not have a gender. It's the human body that has a gender.
Right.
Soul does not mean, like, gender does not mean for a soul. Soul is mujarrat, you know, it's a kind of thing that does not possess these kind of attributes,
right,
according to some of the scholars, the Islamic philosophers and the narrations. And that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Quran he uses a male or the masculine verb or a noun. He talks to both of them. It's because he's talking to the soul, actual soul. And the soul does not have any gender. It's the
right.
It's this body that is being divided into male or female. And that is because, you know, Allah has given us different tasks to do. For example, a soul whose task is to train people, train, you know, the kids, to brought them up,
right,
to give them love. So this soul will have a female body.
Naturally.
On the other hand, the soul which has the responsibility of socializing amongst the people, to go and socialize, to talk to people, to work hard, Allah has given a male body to it. And that's why women cannot become a leader, because her duty is not to socialize or become a social person, to interact with the male and female outside the house.
Right.
You know, there are different reasons. So we need to understand all these things.
Different responsibilities.
Yes,
missions.
Different. On the other hand, in the Quran, when, you know, the question was about the Huri, when the word Huri has been used, it is not said Huri woman.
Right.
The Huri or Huriya has come on its own. Hurul Ayn. Actually, the word is Hurul Ayn.
Yeah.
Yes. Hurul Ayn means the one who has a beautiful eyes. A simple translation. I don't want
right.
to get into the...
The most simple one there.
Yeah, the literal translation
right.
that the eye which has... Which black part is, you know, very
right,
clear.
Right. Because we do have those definitions
yes.
in Arabic.
So I don't want to get into that.
Right.
Rather, it's better to, like, say, having a beautiful eyes. On the other hand, there are other verses of the Quran in which Allah has said, like, in the paradise, whoever wishes, he will get the same thing, like, whatever he wish.
Right.
So in that, even Allah did not said, like, it's for the man or woman.
Right.
So it's common. Huri or Hurul Ayn is a servant, is a paradise servant which will be given to the male and female both.
Right.
It's not only about the male. Both of them will get that, and it is said in the narrations that the Hurul Ayn will have, I think, like 40 servants, other servants who will be under the command of Hurul Ayn, who will serve
right.
this person who will go to the paradise. So for Hurul Ayn, it's not the word woman, and it can be given to the male and female, because in the verses, when you look at the Hurul Ayn, the verses about the Hurul Ayn,
right.
or the, you know, the du'as that we have, supplications, it is in the supplications when we say, oh Allah, give me a Hurul Ayn in the paradise.
Exactly.
The women also recite the same supplication.
No, they skip that part, Sayyid.
But they read the same supplication, the whole of it. And they also ask for the Hurul Ayn. So
right.
basically, Hurul Ayn is not a woman. We should not think materially
right.
about the hereafter, because there we do not have this material word.
Right.
This material thing that we have here, the genders, the, you know, the lust that we have here, it's not over there. That's another word. That's beyond
right.
this. That's beyond this material thoughts that we have.
And we cannot grasp it fully
yes.
by being here. Dear Sayyid, thank you for answering this question
Welcome.
In such a informative way. Also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Yet again, this had been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, and you had been listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Thank you for tuning in.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Sharlara. Today we're going to be asking a question about a very fundamental question which often comes in the mind of non-Muslims. It also comes in the minds of Muslims, but obviously this question wouldn't have come to the mind of Muslims if it wasn't raised by non-Muslims. And that question is Islam a violent religion or not? Now, in order to, and then if it is a violent religion, then